next case is 96-2620, Leonard L. Grace versus Anthony Cook.
You just didn't have enough left. People interested in this case, weren't they?
I don't know why. Maybe a highway patrolman on I-71.
Do you often think about it when you go by milepost 190?
No, every time I see a police officer in a medium strip, I think of it.
Keep your gun in your trunk.
I don't have any gun.
Me either.
Review on a manifest weight standard. It can do that.
Well, but
what did it do wrong?
If you should look in the record,
for evidence to support the decision of the trial court. It didn't do that. It's apparent from the opinion that there was a weighing of the evidence. In fact, the Court of Appeals adopted for every major point testimony of Leonard Grace, which I believe the trial court disregarded entirely on the issue of credibility.
A court can weigh the evidence under a manifest weight standard. Is your complaint that the court took a different view of evidence than the trial court, rather than weighing the manifest weight, whether or not the case met the manifest weight standard?
Well, I think what the court should have done to the manifest weight standard was to search the record for credible, competent evidence to support the trial court's decision under the principle of Scotia versus Colby.
Aren't you saying that what the Court of Appeals really did was substituting its judgment for that of the trial court?
Very definitely. Substituted its judgment. And what happened at the trial of the case is that the only witness for Grace that presented any substantive testimony on the points of adverse possession was Grace himself. And Grace was impeached repeatedly with his deposition testimony, which was completely opposite to the testimony that he gave at trial and completely opposite to the testimony that the Court of Appeals adopted in its decision. And to me, I don't see how a Court of Appeals can do that. And I don't think it fits the rules, but it seems impossible as I go back to look at the record to understand the nuances that occurred in that trial. I mean, I was there, so I can remember it. But if I were the Court of Appeals, I would not have been able to make an intelligent decision about the evidence, doing it in the method that the Court of Appeals did. And I think it's apparent just how they did it.
The Court of Appeals said that, as you know, held that the proper test is clear and convincing evidence. If we hold that the Court of Appeals is wrong and that it should, and the opinion also goes on to sort of quickly say that under either test, your client loses. If we hold that preponderance is the test, what do you think we should do with the case?
Well, I think you should reverse the Court of Appeals and reinstate the judgment of the trial court.
Because the trial court used preponderance, is that?
It's not apparent what the trial court did.
You can't tell, but it looks.
Okay. Yeah, in the post-trial briefs, clear and convincing was in front of the trial court, and preponderance was in front of the trial court.
But the Court of Appeals said on either standard, it reached its conclusion. It added that it, even on a preponderance, right? So
yes.
We aren't in any clear.
I'm glad to be here with that language in the Court of Appeals opinion, because I know that was a serious stumbling block in terms of us bringing this case to the Supreme Court. But I think that now that you've got the case, and it's apparent that the evidence was reweighed improperly, that you can reach the right decision on the burden of proof, and then reverse the Court of Appeals and reinstate the trial court's decision on the basis of
The value of the case to us, I guess, is that there's a disagreement among the districts and certainly in the states about which test applies. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
And we need to make an announcement, I would guess, is the argument that on that issue, whether it's preponderance of the evidence or whether it's clear and convincing, and that would help others decide cases, I would guess.
Yes, you do. But the logic that has to be used is not, in my opinion, is not the Court of Appeals logic. First of all, the Court of Appeals looked to Gill versus Fletcher, and there is that extra language in Gill versus Fletcher. This court said, added the words, quote, shown by overt acts of unquotable character, which clearly indicated an assertion of ownership of the premises to the exclusion of the rights of the real owner. And the Court of Appeals said that this court, all that said the words clear and convincing. Now, we pointed out in our brief that this court does not say clear and convincing, and this court didn't mention burden of proof. That language actually referred to overt acts. And the case of Gill versus Fletcher is enormously understandable, at least to me as a lawyer reading it, and that is, it was a subsurface mineral rights case. Subsurface mineral rights case, so that the surface tenant who had the right to do anything he wanted to at the surface, who was very difficult, if not impossible, for his acts to be judged in light of conventional adverse possession standards. Mm-hmm. And he used the land from one side or the other. And this court's language in Gill versus Fletcher is clearly correct, in my opinion, to that that issue that when you're dealing with subsurface mineral rights owner, you have to go further. You have to do something beyond the traditional standards that have been set down for adverse possession cases.
Counsel, I'm going to take it back to the facts of that because that, the Court of Appeals did get into the facts and the trial court was factually correct and the scene that they turned on is that it wasn't until 12 or 13 years ago that anything happened that could be regarded as open and notorious or other than that, that the evidence perhaps in conflict would seem to indicate some use with permission or joint use and not until the carport is built and the tree is planted. Is there anything that your client can hang their hat on that's they're openly claiming ownership of this land? Is that factually incorrect?
Yes. I was surprised by that Court of Appeals opinion because the testimony was clear that from day one, the Graysons used the entire area as their side yard. You know, it's interesting in this case that there's an aerial photo. It was just a coincidence that Mr. Cook happened to know someone who was a private pilot and may have been flying around and you know, actually took home pictures of it. I don't have to very many
gathered. Well, I mean, it's one thing to have a strip of land that's not that accessible and you let your neighbor's kids play ball on it and mow the grass. And that's a happy circumstance for both sides.
This was a fenced side yard. It was exactly the kind of situation that happens when property is subdivided.
Okay, I thought it wasn't clear at all that your client ever thought they owned clear up to the rail fence.
They knew that the property up to the rail fence was Grace's property. They knew that, and I think that was clear. That is clear in the record. But they used it up to the fence as if it were their own the first day that they moved in. They did everything. They just treated it as their yard. And I think that's what the testimony was in the case. That's what the evidence is. And if you look at the aerial photo, it looks like this is a subdivision lot line.
But when we have neighbors, counsel, you know, neighbors in a residential area, that's what Justice Piper's talking about. And what's one's typical use of a side yard? You know, essentially, it's not growing crops, the sort of use that was made in past cases. When you have neighbors, does everybody have to sort of run out and make sure they march around on their side yard to keep so it's not adverse? I mean, it's... what do people do to ensure that the permissive uses they allow their neighbor to make of, you know, property they own? What must one do then to ensure that the use is not then considered against them?
Well, I think it's important that the fence line be in the right place, and that helps a lot.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, the fence line was 34 feet beyond the actual property line. And so, you know, it was a natural thing for the Cooks to do, to use the property up to that fence line. To all appearances to the outside, that is what the fence line, where the fence line was. And it's another interesting thing in this case, Justice Cook, that Mr. Grace actually built this house in the wrong place and then moved next door and is in jeopardy of losing this property to adverse possession. I mean, usually in a situation of adverse possession, you have two innocent parties. One of them is going to lose their property by adverse possession. The other is, you know, stuck with some horrible calamity like turning your house around or tearing your kitchen off or digging up your driveway, which is, you know, the ordinary case. In this case, Mr. Grace is not an innocent party. He put the house in the wrong place. Then he sold it to Mr. Cook for presumably, you know, in a profitable transaction.
Well,
when 22 years later, he's caught to bulldoze his stuff bigger than wood.
He went out and got an easement from his folks, which is a matter of record, which would indicate that he realized that his driveway wasn't even on his own property.
You know, I think what happened, Justice Piper, was that Mr. Cook didn't know anything about that, but
he's charged with knowledge of that, and then
yes.
That's recorded.
No question.
Wouldn't that sort of put you on notice? I
think it was originated by the title company. You know, somebody saw that there was encroachment, and then after the closing, they got the easement.
Then that puts you on notice where your property line is. Is there at the driveway, not up at the rail fence?
Yes, and I think Mr. Cook did know where the approximately where the property line is. He knew that his use of Mr. Grace's property was hostile to Grace.
Well, in fact, did Mr. Grace on occasion drive his tractor over this piece of property in order to get back to his other fields and his other crops?
No, that was...
That's what our record shows.
It's certainly Mr. Grace's contention that he drove through that. I don't believe that it's believable. If you look at the aerial photo, which is an exhibit and supplement, I think you'll see that it's a preposterous notion. It was the testimony of Grace that he looked for rabbits in the strip.
Okay, well, the legal issue in this case, as the Chief Justice suggested, is clear and convincing versus preponderance. Your proposition of law 2A says a majority of the Ohio appellate courts have followed preponderance. Wouldn't it be fair to say, or is it fair to say, that the Court of Appeals did a pretty good and thorough job analyzing that was a judicial error early on, and other courts have just cited the wrong case to start with, and that's why we're where we are today? Isn't their public policy argument and their analysis of all those Court of Appeals cases pretty good?
No, I beg to differ, but I don't think it is. The court guided its logic to the McGinnish case, which is a lost deed case.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the McGinnish case, they immediately launch into a discussion of the Manos case. The Manos is just a lost deed fiction case, and
okay,
the court thought that logic.
Without talking about the merits of each of those cases, is it fair to say that you think preponderance of the evidence is the standard, even though the public policy is adverse to adverse possession?
Well, it is adverse to adverse possession, but
okay.
There's a five-element test.
Then why wouldn't we have clear and convincing evidence be the standard?
I'm sorry?
If it is adverse to adverse possession, why wouldn't clear and convincing be the standard?
Because Ohio already has the strictest, one of the strictest group of a combination of elements and time period. It's already strict enough.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Mr. Barrett.
Court of Appeals opinion, you sure got more than you bargained for when you went there, didn't you? You got a book, a treatise almost.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you agree with everything that's in there?
I wouldn't agree with it entirely, but I think it was a very well-reasoned opinion, and I think the advantage of this court taking the case throughout the state, obviously there's some confusion as to what the burden of proof is. Also, I believe, some confusion as to the specific elements. And if I may comment in general with regard to the elements, and also in particular with regard to subject case. First of all, for there to be adverse possession, burden of proof is on the person who is adversely possessing. And we would submit clear and convincing evidence is the proper standard as a matter of policy, because the adverse possessor is basically trying to take title from a person who has acquired title by deed or other written instrument and who has title as a matter of record. So when you're trying to defeat something that's a matter of public record, the county recorder's office, where someone has received a general warranty deed for his property, and things of that nature, if you're going to defeat that, set it aside, and we believe the clear and convincing evidence as a matter of policy is the proper standard.
Mr. Barrett, what standard did the trial court apply?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, what
standard. And doesn't counsel Mr. Wilson make the point that we have a case that requires us to presume that the court applied the right standard in the absence of a request for findings of fact and conclusions of law, where there's a bench trial? So we're really in the posture, because there was no request, we're in the posture of presuming that whatever the standard is, this court applied it. The trial court.
I would say generally that's the question.
Can we get to that question?
Your Honor, what I would say is that that deals more with factual disputes. This case is really about what's the proper application. application of the law to the facts in this case.
Well, we want it, if we're going to do, have any reason to hear this case, it probably would be a good thing to establish the evidentiary standard of proof. But that's somewhat foiled by the absence of a request for findings of fact.
Somewhat, and I would say, Your Honor, that the Court of Appeals corrected that quite well by stating that whether the standard is preponderance or whether the standard is clear and convincing, in either case, it's a matter of law. Those set of facts do not establish the elements. And each of those elements must be proven, and they must exist for 21 years. If I could comment about each of the elements. The first one, the open and actual. That is, it must be obvious. And it's very debatable here whether this obviously was adverse possession. It was in a neighborly situation, a neighborly accommodation, cordiality. I think the Court of Appeals words apply easement is the best. There's no dispute that Mr. Cook, on direct examination at the trial by Mr. Wilson, it's on 455 of the transcript, he asked him, did you ask for permission to cut the grass over the strip? And he said yes, so permission was granted. Secondly, the element is notorious. It must be known. Looking at the facts, there is no way that Mr. Grace could have known that Mr. Cook was adversely possessing his property. Again, it was a neighborly accommodation.
On the other hand, how could the trial judge go so wrong? He's the one who heard all this.
Very simply, Your Honor, I think the trial judge did not understand the elements of adverse possession. I could give you other reasons, which might be speculation on my part, but confining it to the record, I would say that he simply said, well, these people have lived next to each other for 21 years. They used the side yard, therefore I'm going to give it to them. And our point is that the neighborly accommodation, elements of permission, all defeat the adversity, hostility, and continuity is a very important element. There was no continuous adverse use of this parcel. It was intermittent, it was sporadic. There must be some permanence. Now, if there had been an issue of color of title, if the folks believed that they owned up to the fence line, it'd been one thing, but they didn't. So, where there's no color of title, we believe that the correct interpretation of the law is that the person who's adversely possessing must do something physically or put up a fence. This was
that's the same question I asked Mr. Wilson. This is an odd scenario where your use can be non-use. I mean, because you play on the yard or the children play on the yard sometimes, and your neighbor doesn't walk his dog. I mean, it's just peculiar because crops are historically or some outlying area where somebody sets up a cabin or that sort of thing. But in this case, a side yard which has, in any sense, sporadic use. It's odd what standard we should apply for what amounts to use and exclusive use of a side yard.
Your Honor,
I don't know the answer.
I
just meant what kind of use.
Okay. But you'll need to answer the question from the justice.
Yeah, I was just wondering what kind of use, and really it's a rhetorical question. So.
Well, Your Honor, I agree. In a rural area, it's typically crops or pasture, and there's a fence line standard. There must be some physical occupation. In an urban setting, it's a building. I would say the doctrine of adverse possession works well if someone has built a structure in downtown area, they cross over an inch or two or foot with a building after 21 years, they shouldn't have to demolish it.
Because, Counselor, here it appears to be who cut the grass and who didn't cut the grass.
Yes, Your
Honor. The only element starts is going 21 years out. Is it uncontroverted that permission to cut the grass was granted?
Yes, Your Honor. Based upon the direct examination and the answer of the appellant, yes, Your Honor. Now, they disagree with that in their briefs. If you look at 455 in their supplement, the question was asked in 1970, did you ask for permission to cut the grass? The answer was yes, we asked for permission to mow the grass. And again, the lower courts have held that such things as cutting the grass, planting the yard, putting up temporary structures, a temporary swing set, putting in an above-ground pool, or you need to keep leave out the summer and take it back in the winter. All of those things defeat continuity. There must be some firm physical possession, whether it's crops in a rural area, a fence for a pasture, or a building, a garage in an urban area. There must be some physical occupation for 21 years for the continuity to exist for 21 years.
So if you got permission to cut the grass, but then you went out and planted a row of roses at the extreme edge of the property and tended to those, that might be an indicia of effort.
It moves in that direction. I don't think it's enough, because if you have permission to cut the grass, you put in roses, you still have to do things which are inconsistent with the rightful owner's ownership. You have to exclude him. You have to make it clear that it's adverse to his ownership interests. It has to be open to him, known to him. So I guess that if you're going to defeat record title, it should be clear and convincing evidence.
Does this, do you think you met the preponderance of the evidence standard here?
Well, I think we met either standard. Again, right. This is a trespass action, and the burden of proof is not on the appellee. It was on the appellant, being an adverse possession case, refolding record title, having acquired title by deed. The burden of proof is not on us.
Okay, I'm sorry, I see the wrong way, but you do agree. The Court of Appeals said either way.
Either way, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. We don't know what the trial court
did. No matter how the facts are weighed, no matter how they're looked at, even if we construe them strongly in favor of the appellant, that does not constitute adverse possession. You don't have diversity as required by law. You don't have exclusivity. You don't have continuity. You don't have notoriety. I do believe I have 2 minutes left, Your Honor. I'd like to let the counsel for the mortgage company.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Barrett.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Fleming.
May I please report to Michelle Fleming, representing Mayflower Savings and Loans. Your Honor, my client is extremely concerned about the precedent which might be established if this court were to reverse the Court of Appeals and hold that under the circumstances of this case, that the Coast had established adverse possession, and particularly as against the mortgagee of this property. This mortgage was executed by Mr. Grace in January of 1992. That mortgage is going to Exhibit 11, at which time Mr. Grace was record owner of lot 43, subject only to a 5-foot by 130-foot driveway easement in favor of the Cook.
Does your client come to your firm by virtue of Mr. Grace, or does Mr. Grace come to your firm by virtue of your client? Who do you?
The trial court, Mayflower, was represented by Rick Landrum of Rory Sager.
Okay, so
and
how do you get here now?
I was substituted as counsel for Mayflower.
So really,
the first scenario you said is that the client comes to my firm by virtue of Mr. Grace.
Okay. So you're the same firm is representing both Mr. Grace and Mayflower. Is there a conflict? Are their interests adverse at all?
In the ultimate analysis, I do not think their interests are adverse. In the ultimate analysis, Mayflower is going to look to Mr. Grace for the payment of the mortgage, and will look to our security in the property, however much property there is, for the ultimate satisfaction of the mortgage in the event that Mr. Grace should.
So it makes it a little adverse, doesn't it? Because if Grace loses, he still owes you.
And that's why we are here, because we are interested in protecting our security and also in protecting the general principle of law that mortgage companies are entitled to rely upon interests in property which are of record and of record only. And as this court
So do you think we have abolished the law of ancestors?
I don't think that's necessary. The General Assembly could decide to do that as the Board of Appeals, but that is up to the General Assembly to do.
There isn't any, really any circumstance under which your client, or similarly situated clients, to find anything redeemed by the law of ancestors.
I think not, Your Honor. I think the mortgage industry would prefer that this doctrine not exist. The policy of the state of Ohio has been for over 100 years that all instruments creating an interest in real property should be recorded, and that any instrument not so recorded is invalid. In fact, the statute 530125 uses the term fraudulent as against the bona fide purchaser for value.
Isn't there another side of that coin for you folks, if that is where there isn't any reason to go get a new survey, and the neighbors both mistakenly believe the property line is somewhere where it isn't, and the person to whom you loan the money has built a carport, and it isn't theirs.
The mortgagee would then try to be the advocate of adverse possession.
Right.
But such a circumstance in a particular case, which is not this case, I think it would be a very particular factual circumstance, and that in general, the industry would be much more interested in having clear title based on recorded instruments only. Again, I want to emphasize, I know I have very limited time, that in this case, the mortgage was executed after the 21-year period, which the Cook now claims had already passed. In other words, they say that they began to adversely possess the side yard, which they knew that they did not acquire, the moment they took title in September of 1970. In other words, at the time when they asked permission to Willow the Grass, that in fact, they were intending to adversely possess it would be their argument. They say in their brief that they had perfected title 21 years after the closing in September of 1970. That would be September 91. This mortgage was executed in January of 1992. As of that time, they had not taken no action to perfect this title, and as to third parties out there in the world, such as my client, they had no notice that there were any adverse claims to the property.
Thank you, Ms. Lemming.
Thank you.
Mr. Wilson, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Did your client have any knowledge that this property was being remortgaged?
Your Honor, Mayflower didn't. This is an equity line that Mr. Gray shot after the dispute arose, and there's a fraction of the value of the property. Mayflower didn't care enough about the mortgage loan to do a survey. They didn't care enough to participate in the trial. Mr. Lander did not participate in the trial in this case.
That's not my question. My question is, did your client have any knowledge?
No, we had no idea that there was a mortgage after the dispute had arisen, and I believe that there was some mortgage before that. I believe that the record will reflect that this is not a case about cutting grass. That my belief is that the record will show that the Cooks used the side yard just exactly as a side yard should be used, all aspects of it. I think that under Moonslaw Eber, the famous United States Supreme Court case involving a piece of downtown Cincinnati property. That case stands for the proposition that adverse possession is adverse and meets the condition when it's used based upon the nature of the property. This was a side yard. It was used as a side yard from day one, 1970.
Thank you, Commissioner. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.
All rise.